seminar and discussion. As in last week's and previous weeks, I should say I'm Tony Travers, Associate Dean in the School of Public Policy, but also work in LSE Cities with Ricky Burdett. And as in previous weeks, the purpose of the event is to allow us to talk to a senior figure in public policy, somebody who, in this occasion, very much as last week, actually, when Vanessa Rubio was our guest, has worked, as it were, right at the front line of delivering policy in a complex environment, even more complex in the world of which we're a part. And our guest is Sir Peter Hendy, who is currently the chair of Network Rail, which is the United Kingdom or the Great Britain rail infrastructure provider, but we'll catch more about that as we go along. He's been in that role since 2015, so that's responsible for all the hardware and many of the biggest railway stations in Britain. Before that, he was a Commissioner of Transport for London, so that is one of the most extensive urban transport networks in the world, consisting of the underground buses, taxi regulation, Uber regulation, everything regulation, river services, and roads, major roads. But he's come to that, having started in the transport industry as a graduate trainee, and went on to run a bus company in the private sector, so has experience of running a private company. That was part of a system that operated in London starting in the 80s when buses moved over from being provided directly by the city to being provided on franchise agreements with the public sector. And then he went on from that role to being head of surface transport in London. That's the buses and roads and things other really than the underground. And from that in 2006, went on to become transport commissioner. And it is transport commissioner of a massive public transport enterprise. I'm sure Peter will say more about this, but one of the world's most extensive urban railway systems, and also I think the world's biggest bus system. I think it's certainly among the world's biggest bus systems. He's also, and he did that from 2006 to 2015, and he's also currently of immediate interest besides the chair of the Olympic Legacy Development Corporation, which is the organization charged with taking what was left at the end of the 2012 Olympics and turning that very large section of the city into a permanent improved part of the city. As such, he's worked with two mayors as mayor of London, actually probably three mayors actually, Peter, I look for, yes, three mayors, but certainly two as transport commissioner. So Boris Johnson, now the British Prime Minister, and after that, Sadiq Khan. No, you were working with Sadiq Khan, you've worked with him subsequently, obviously at the Legacy Development Corporation, but previously with Ken Livingstone, the Boris Johnson's predecessor. So he's worked with three different mayors in different roles and with three different prime ministers and heaven knows how many transport secretaries, Peter, presumably.
About 15 now.
So this gives Peter extraordinary expertise at all levels of the practice of public policy in a part of government which is simultaneously highly engineering heavy and infrastructure heavy, but also curiously political, particularly I think perhaps more so in Britain than many countries. The railway and public transport systems are highly political, and that's partly because we try to run them with lower subsidies than many other countries, which I'm sure we'll hear more about in a moment. I should say on a personal note, I sat with him quite recently on a review of Britain's policy of building a further high-speed railway line, which is now being built from London to Birmingham and then on to Manchester. And last but not least, it would be only fair to say Peter is unique amongst people I know in actually owning a red London bus personally. So owns one of the iconic London Routemaster buses, and very elegant things they are too.
They are. In fact, Two and a half, Tony.
Two and a half there. Yes, there's two route masters and one of their predecessor, whose name I've now forgotten, but Peter won't have done. Okay, so let's just get going. What we'll do is it's the normal format. I'll start off with a few questions to Peter about his career and the practice of government. And then there'll be an opportunity for all of you to weigh in either with a question through the chat, or we can bring you in directly, depending on which way you'd like to do it. So feel free to put any questions in the chat or put a hand up when we get to that part of the evening. Okay, so let's get going. So Peter, thanks for joining us this evening. I'm sorry it's in this way rather than the more sociable way of inviting you to our new excellent building at the LSE, and some of the students may actually luckily be there, which we're not. But can I just begin? I mentioned you went into the industry as a graduate trainee. What motivated you to go into transport as opposed to, say, I don't know, civil engineering or some other form of career?
Gosh, well, look, all you're going to get this evening is confessions, and I confess that I'm an enthusiast. I've always been an enthusiast, and for people who are enthusiastic about transport, it means objects and things. And I'm very fond of those buses which you saw, and I'm fond of steam locomotives and other pieces of objet d'art. Though fortunately, I don't own a steam locomotive; otherwise, I'd be broke. But what I learnt was, and also I did economics and geography as a first degree. I wasn't very good at economic theory, but I did enjoy geography. But I think that So many people in transport either start out with an interest in how it's provided and the mechanics of it. But what you get into if you get into transport is two things. One of which is that it's full of interesting people. Nobody gets into the transport. Very few people get into the transport industry because they think it's a career and they're genuinely interested. Loads of people get in because it's just a job and you can get one. And some of them stay a lifetime and some of them only stay a few months. But the other thing you realise is that actually a whole load of discussion about transport, and I suspect we'll come back to this again and again, is how it works. And what I've learned over 45 years is that it's much more important about what it's for. And what it's for is that connectivity drives economic growth, it drives jobs, it drives job creation, it drives house building, and it drives social cohesion. And when you get into transport, even at the gutty end, because I was a bus driver and a bus conductor in the days when we had bus conductors, and I've been supervisors, and I was an inspector, a very bad inspector, wasn't very good at it, and a manager. And you can quickly become entirely engrossed in how it's provided. But actually, that's not why people travel. People travel in order to go places and do things. And as a transport provider, I've certainly learned, at least in the last 20 years, if not before, that actually, if you can engage people at parties by telling good stories about driving buses and about being an inspector and about how glorious steam locomotives are. But people travel for the economic, and social consequences of travel. And many people in my industries don't remember that. And that's what I'm most interested in now, and that's why what I've done, not me doing it, but what I've done is important. And that's the link, that's the big link with politicians and public policy. And that's what's kept me certainly fully engaged in the last 20 years.
Okay, I want to come on to politicians and all of that in a moment, but at a sort of personal level, when you went in as a graduate trainee and started doing, you know, really, you know, like a police officer on the beat in some ways, did you have any expectation of ending up as a sort of grandee dealing with mayors and prime ministers? Did you have that as an objective, or did you just think, I'd like to work in the transport industry for its own sake?
Well, if you ask the people I went to school with, who some of whom I still know, we have virtual Zoom calls, they'll all tell you, oh yeah, Peter was always going to wind up in charge of London Transport. I never really thought that. I thought that I would be interested in how it was provided, and I was interested actually. And for me as a middle class kid, it was an entry to a different world of people, and some of them, actually some of them, as I said, drifted into the bus industry because it was just a job, and others were passionate about it, and still more didn't give a shit. They just wanted the money. And that provided some serious entertainment. And at every level I've ever got to, I've been surprised to get there. And then I've looked round and thought, blimey, well, I can do this just as well as anybody else can. And of course, you'll know, Tony, and it's worth saying to this audience that I certainly didn't intend to be the transport commissioner at all. I thought if I did have a dream job, it was being in charge of the bus service. Because I'd been in it and out of it for at that stage for 31 years. But when the previous transport commissioner was sacked by Ken Livingston as a chief officer in Transport for London, I looked round and there was an acute danger that one of my colleagues would be appointed, and none of us could bear it. So I thought I'd better apply for the job. And I did sufficient due diligence to actually get it, but I never intended really to do it. I actually loved running the bus service, and I'm not sure that at that stage I really wanted to get into some of the political wrangles. But I've realised since then that that's quite inevitable, and that actually more people who go into the provision of public services ought to expect to have close encounters with politicians and civil servants and the Treasury and government, because we consume a load of public money, you know?
Yes, and that does take us neatly onto the issue of, presumably when you worked in the bus industry or even early days in management, policy was what you had to deal with, presumably. It just was like the weather. It wasn't something you would influence very much. Do people, if you're working, because I do think this is important in terms of thinking to other people's lives, if you're working in the bus system on the railways, do you have any sense at all? Do you think your colleagues down the line have any sense about what public policy is, what management is, or is it just them up there, just like the weather?
Well, transport is vocational, and the bus industry and the railway industry are both vocational. Nearly everybody who works in it has some feeling towards what they do, and the railway probably more because there's more long service, and a lot of people love the concept of the railway and are quite proud to serve people, but they regard the management as transitory, particularly in the British railway system, where a lot of the management actually is transitory because the management come and go with franchises, but the employees and the trade unions are still there. But when I joined London Transport in the 1970s, it was more subversive than that, because actually what got out as a public service was pretty awful, and was the consequence of a mixture of management incompetence and trade union militancy. And the intentions of the management might have been good, but the result of it on the road was dreadful. Yeah. And you could see that, and you could see that actually something needed to be done. And at one stage I worked for a guy called Ralph Bennett, who's dead now, who was firstly the deputy chairman and then the chairman of London Transport. They used to, my young colleague Joanna's on the call, and she's my assistant currently, probably in the same sort of position. So I was 2 years into the job, and I worked for Ralph. And I used to write the minutes of meetings, which recorded that there were 500 buses off the road, and then there was a massive staff shortage. And I can always remember the guys in charge of recruiting bus drivers, a bloke called Eddie Dempsey. And he was just wringing his hands in anguish. They didn't seem to know how to deal with it. And they also didn't seem to me to know how to deal with the politics of it. London Transport at that stage was responsible to the Greater London Council, and the officer cadre, and that's a good way of describing it, because they did think that they were like that, were utterly resistant to these these politicians being in charge, and did their very best not to tell them anything and not to do what they wanted. And it was quite an extraordinary experience. And actually, I still look back on that. Poor old Ralph, he was a really nice bloke, but in the end, he was forced to resign by Horace Cutler, who was the leader of the GLC, who was a crook and pretty odious bloke. But Ralph had not worked out the political relationships, and also couldn't sustain any independence because what the service he ran was so awful. You know, I can remember in the, these are good stories that I can remember the summer of 1976, I think. We had a route that never ran at all. That was, it had a timetable, it had a schedule, but the staff and the supervisors and the management had decided it wasn't worth running. So they redeployed the staff available to other routes. They took the numbers off the stops and it didn't run. And it didn't run until it was withdrawn formally. The 30, which in those days ran between Roehampton and Hackney, in the summer of 1976, Putney decided they wouldn't go east of Baker Street, and Hackney, who ran the other end of it, decided they wouldn't go west of King's Cross. So there were two pieces of 30, and the bit down the Euston Road didn't run at all. And the management said, just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, well, it's not running then. And you're not going to survive in a political environment and naively when what you do is so bad. And that stayed with me all my life. So the first principle in TfL was you had to run a good service every day, because you weren't even going to get any credibility from your own customers if you didn't do that. And you certainly couldn't stand up to political scrutiny. And that stayed with me the whole of my working life. Still at Network Rail every morning. I mean, I've got Chief Executive Andrew, and he's brilliant. But I look at the phone every morning, and I want to know what's running, because if it's not running well somewhere, somebody's not going to be very pleased. And if it's not running sufficiently well, you know, Secretary of State might be on the phone, and you better know about it. You know.
I mean, I do remember myself. Sorry, not to reminisce either, but. In those days on the bus, you still see them, of course. Buses still have these helpful notices on the bus stops in London, and it used to say, timetable shown on this at this bus stop does not guarantee that the buses will run according to the timetable or at all. Anyway, but moving on to the politics, or deeper into the politics, because you worked, you know, first at the Greater London, or London Transport as it then was. And by the way, for those listening who don't know the history of it, the way in which transport in London has been passed from national government to local government, back to national government, back to local government within 45 years or whatever it is itself not encouraging, in the way that Network Rail is itself the third iteration of the way of controlling the rail infrastructure in 30 years. So you've had to deal in your career with an enormous amount of political change by politicians of the systems that you've worked in. And yet, in some ways, the managers, the operators, are always there. They have to be, it's rather like National Health Service reorganization, which is about to happen in Britain yet again. Whatever the sort of organizational arrangements politicians put in place, the people who run the service, be it the National Health Service or in this case the railway, have to come in on the next Monday morning and pick it up. So what do you kind of, you've mentioned one politician, but as you move forward into the period when you were working at City Hall with the mayors of London, Ken Livingstone and then Boris Johnson, what was different about them in this new enterprise, Transport for London, as to compared with working in effect in a nationalised industry, which is what it had been like at least for part of the time before?
Sure. So, absolutely. I mean, London Transport, formally controlled in the 80s by the Greater London Council, of which then Ken Livingstone was its last leader, and Mrs. Thatcher abolished it. In fact, London Transport was nationalised in order to get out of the control of the council, I can remember. And it happened over, it happened in 24 hours, I think, Tony. It happened, I went on holiday to Ireland. And when we came back, it had been nationalised and was under state control. So the mayoralty is in my view still a wonderful thing, and I'd hope you'd agree. I mean, Britain doesn't have a great tradition of strong municipal management, and generally municipal political power has been steadily eroded from a very small base over many years until the Greater London Authority Act. And that in itself is quite an interesting example, because it was business in London who started the case for a mayoralty, because business in London felt, and I think rightly so, that actually London's economic position was deteriorating because of a lack of leadership. And the Blair government, as you know, went through the Greater London Authority Act, which was then the largest act ever passed, and in the process created TfL, which was, in the history of London's transport, is the most comprehensive transport authority ever. And it put it under the direct control of the mayor, and the mayoralty is now, as you said, on its third mayor in 20 years. But there are many differences. I mean, one of them is, and we can talk about this too, dealing with government is not dealing with one person. I'm appointed to Network Rail by the Secretary of State for Transport, but I deal with a whole range of politicians, including several ministers in the Transport Department. I deal with mostly with the Department of Transport, but that's hundreds of people. And those politicians change quite frequently. Far more frequently than the government does. So the mayoralty is different, and is the reason why, you know, there's so much to look at. So anybody who's elected as the mayor is elected for 4 years, and you've got, and if you run Transport for London, you've got a very personal relationship with somebody who has a lot of power. The mayor's office is there to help and maybe enforce what the mayor does, but it's the mayor who is answerable directly to this huge electorate of several million people. And I think there's a very real difference between the relationship of if you lead, a big authority, and the transport authority is the largest thing the mayor's responsible for, and a mayor who's there for 4 years and might well want to get re-elected, compared with running a state industry for a large government. We can go through those difficulties, and I'm sure that's those differences, and I'm sure that's what you want to do. I think it sort of helped that actually I was there at the start with Ken when he was the first mayor, not long after he was elected, and he had a blank canvas to at least create the mayoralty, although guided by the Act. And it's and all of that is a pretty sophisticated and actually largely very well engineered process. So the mayor's responsible for the London Plan, which is a long-term economic and spatial development strategy for the city. That's a legal obligation to produce one. Then there's an obligation to produce a transport strategy, which supports the London Plan, and the transport strategy sets out what you need to do in transport terms to create the economic and spatial plan that the mayor set out. And then you've got a transport authority which can have a long-term budget, a long-term business plan and a budget, and a direct responsibility to the mayor for not only discharging all those things, but for actually running the service on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's a very potentially very powerful relationship if you can make it work.
Now, you have, as I mentioned in passing, you were appointed as Transport Commissioner by Ken Livingstone, who was known as a left-wing Labour politician. I'm not sure he was that left-wing when he became Mayor of London. That's another for another day. And then when he left office, in a sense, you kept your position as Transport Commissioner. I think many listening will think that is unusual, because in other mayoral systems, when the mayor certainly changes with political party, and even in the same party, often there's a clean sweep of commissioners. In fact, because of sort of lingering traditions in Britain, both the Transport Commissioner and to less success the police commissioner and the fire commissioner all stayed on when Livingston left office and Johnson became mayor, though the police commissioner didn't survive very long. But what was it? Perhaps you could just first sort of characterise what working for either mayor is like, but then sort of working for a Labour politician of the kind that Ken Livingstone was, and then a very, very, very different personality, not better or worse, just different, which Boris Johnson was, and indeed they both still are. So there's an insight into the personalities, but also into what you had to do to adapt to these different, and indeed to survive the change.
Sure. So Ken was an extraordinary man. He was, you know, I think he is still left wing. I'm not sure that I would claim. I would agree with you, Tony. I'm not quite sure how left wing he is sometimes, but he had two characteristics that were really important as the first mayor. One of which is he had a very clear vision about what he wanted London to be and to do, and that was written into his first London plan. And I think actually by inspection, if you compare his plan with Boris's plan and then with Sadiq's plan, they're almost the same, actually. There are some differences that each of his successors would exaggerate, but actually it's still basically the same plan. But also Ken was a good manager. He's one of the few politicians I've ever met who could have run an international business because he understood the art of delegation. And he appointed people and expected them to do the job. And those were good characteristics, which actually made working for him not easy to do, because he could be very direct and he had some very strong views. But he also understood that actually, if you'd done a reasonable job, he would be loyal to you. In fact, he was rather too loyal, as you remember, Tony, to one or two of his acolytes when maybe he shouldn't have been. And inevitably you get to know somebody reasonably well, don't you, in that relationship. I would go and see both of them every week with some of my management team, and you would meet them and you would get to know how they behaved. And I used to take them both things sometimes that I knew they wouldn't agree with, and I knew what would happen, but sometimes you had to do it. But I could also foresee what the outcome would be, and you'd get used to it. So, you know, Ken was determined to give free travel for people under 16, and I didn't like losing the fares income. And I knew he was going to do it. And I said, don't do that, because it will cost us a fortune. And he said, no, I'm going to do it. And he did do it. And we had to live with the cost of doing it. And I knew why he'd done it, because once you put it in, it was really hard to take it out. And in fact, Boris also did some things in that respect. When the mayoralty changed, I mean, it's an interesting process. And what I realised, so I think we got one thing right, because all we did, when in the mayoral election of 2008, until about 6 weeks before the election, it seemed inconceivable that Boris Johnson, who then didn't have any real standing in London, could win. And then it became obvious during the course of the last 2 months of the election that indeed he might win. And I got somebody very bright, Isabel Dedring, who you know, Tony, and I got her simply to write down everything that all the candidates said they would do. And we worked on what they said in the days leading up to the election in the certain knowledge that one of them would win. And if it had been Ken, I knew what Ken was going to promise, because he'd already told me, because I already worked for him. And if it was Boris, we had a list. And actually, I can remember the first time we went to see him. And actually, the reason I suspect now, well, I always suspected, and I think it's worth saying now, that the police commissioner didn't say anything. He said, I'm responsible for the safety of London, and I'll look after it for you. And when my turn came, I said, listen, not quite like that, but effectively, here's what you said during the election. Here are some things I can do for you now. Here are some things we can do later. And there are one or two things that I can't do at all, but we won't linger on them now. And I sort of thought that actually you better address what it is that they wanted to do practically, Boris had won the election without understanding really what the nature of what he was going to be in charge of. I think now, as I thought then, that he'd taken the job as a stepping stone to something else, which turned out to be true. But you had to address what they'd said in the election. Beyond that, it was really quite difficult. What I also realised, and if you speak to Mike Brown, who succeeded me and was the mayor, was the commissioner when Boris was replaced by Sadiq, the dial gets set back to zero. You start on day one of a new mayor with no credibility whatever, and indeed quite a lot of suspicion that you might be the man of the previous mayor and that you might have to justify yourself. And in fact, I'm probably quite lucky because Boris has a streak, which is that the more people tell him to do something, the more he rebels against doing it. And you might know, Tony, that he was advised by a very large number of people to fire me on the grounds that I'd been the Transport Commissioner under Ken and I was a communist. And in the end, Boris got so fed up with him, he got all the people who worked for him together and said, "You can all stop telling me this because I've decided to keep Hendy on." And I know that's true, though I wasn't in the room. And that my survival actually partially is solely dependent on Boris having a streak of perversity and not wishing to do what people kept telling him to.
Noble indeed. I mean, I think many listening will be, I mean, there are two ways that when you get a change of government, the officials delivering services, there are two models really, aren't there? There's the normal mayoral presidential model or governor, where when the personality changes, almost all the commissioners and senior ministers or whatever it is go. And then there's the parliamentary model, which Britain has had, which until relatively recently, anybody who was a senior official in government stayed on, or indeed in local government. But you were working as a commissioner in a mayoral model, which was the first one of its kind in the UK. So the implication is that you as a person were able to, in a very British civil servant's Mandarin way, to say, "I will work for, within the bounds of reason, somebody on the left or on the right, because what?" I mean, because that you must have decided that.
Because actually, basically, what you're delivering matters to them no matter who they are, actually. You know, the basic output of Transport for London is an effective and acceptable transport service every morning. So you know, getting the best person for the job ought to be solely about who can best do it. And that's why I mentioned earlier on my concentration on daily service. I know enough about running transport systems to know that you've just got no credibility with anybody, let alone the person you're working for, if the service is no good. I relentlessly traded on that. I mean, Ken actually didn't need to know because he used it every day. And actually you could tell him things and he understood the geography and he understood how it worked because he'd been around for so long. I started with Boris texting him every morning. When I got up, I'd read the 30 or 40 emails about what's wrong with the tube and the buses and the road system. And I would distill it into one text, the length of a text message, referring to every method of transport. And I sent it to him every morning for a number of reasons. One of which was that he didn't know what TfL did, but I told him it every bloody morning of the year, including Saturdays and Sundays. And I wanted him to be reminded what we did, and I wanted him to know how well we'd done it, and I wanted him, if he was going on the radio at 8:30, to know if the Northern Line was up the creek, not to make an idiot of himself by pretending it was all right when it wasn't. But that was also a tactic, which is to say, look, I'm in charge of all this lot. Whatever you want to do in congestion charging and, you know, banning alcohol consumption, the basis of what we do is the daily service that we run. And in that, I think I was successful because in the end, he would ring me if that message didn't turn up. And I took to doing it even on Christmas Day when we ran nothing. I'd send him a message telling him that there were 2,000 or 3,000 people out digging the track up because he wouldn't know unless he told him. And I made it my business to make it clear to him that actually, you know, whatever he thought of TfL and the policy it was discharging, it was doing a job every day. And and that job needed to be done. And I'll shamelessly, I'll look back now and say that was a tactic. He had no idea what TfL did, but I bloody well told him. And in the end, he knew, because he got the message every morning, and I included the Woolwich Ferry on it and the river services. And when we started Bycar, I got that on it, because he needed to know, because the citizens who'd elected him were depending on it.
So that was a sort of, I should have said at the beginning for everybody, this is operated under the so-called Chatham House rule, which is you're free to discuss what's said, but not exactly who said it, which in a meeting this small, it means you can understand what you've heard, but not attribute it directly to the speaker or indeed to me, given the question I'm about to ask, which is this. When I'm asked by journalists to compare Livingstone and Johnson, I say that Ken Livingstone had a real interest in policy, and you've sort of made this point. He knew what he wanted to do, he knew how a machine worked, and he knew therefore what to ask people to deliver. He had formed ideas about policy. Whereas I suspect that Boris Johnson was driven more by getting into power than any sense of what he'd do with power and therefore with policy. Do you think my observation is a fair one?
Yes. I think that's absolutely right. But then your job in running one of these public service organisations is education, not only about what the thing does, but about what you could do and what was the right thing to do. And actually, you know, what we learned together was that if he could say in any terms, even vague and even in the vaguest terms, if he could say what he wanted to do, we would go away and try to do it. So here's a good example. During the election campaign, he had promised to restore, for those of you who know, in East London, there's a Blackwall Tunnel, which is an old one and a new one, though the new one's quite old itself now. And the old one is northbound and the new one's southbound. And there's more traffic goes from south to north in the morning and it goes back in the evening. And the southbound tunnel is modern and you can go through it faster. And we used to operate a contra flow in the southbound tunnel. So there are three lanes going north, two in the northbound tunnel, one in the southbound tunnel. And the police stopped the contra flow system because of some terrible fatalities of motorbike users. And they just stopped it. And it became an election issue. And Boris committed himself to reintroducing it. So the day after the election, he said, when are you going to reintroduce it? And I said, I can't, because the police won't let me. And he looked at me and I said, but actually, if what you're saying is you would like me to get the same flow through the northbound tunnel as we used to get with the contra flow, will that do? And he said, well, I think it will. It's not quite what I want, but you can't. And we went away and we did it. And I'll tell you how we did it. We did it this will sound quite incredible. We did it by a scheme where we diverted overhyped lorries and vehicles that looked obviously overloaded and unroadworthy into a compound where the police nicked them. And actually so every overhyped lorry would block up the tunnel for 20 or 30 minutes whilst it got removed. And every morning somebody had run out of fuel and gum it up for hours. And we managed to find a way of getting them into police custody. And then every operator of overhyped lorries and dodgy old vans knew that if you got into the Blackwall Tunnel, you'd get nicked. And in the end, we got the flow through the two northbound bores that we used to get through three bores by doing what he wanted another way. And he didn't know that that's what he wanted to do, but we worked out how to produce the solution that he was looking for. And I think that's really quite a good example. And to do that, frankly, Tony, you need some personal relationship. And if I'd said, I'm the Transport Commissioner and I'm not doing it because it's unsafe, I think I would have been on rocky ground. And I didn't say that. I said, the police won't let me, which was true. So I blamed them. And I said, you give us 3 months and we'll go away and work out how to do what you want to produce the effect you want in a different way from the one that you imagine.
So a sort of no, but rather than no. Anyway, I'm going to move on to the questions now, because we've got about halfway through and there's loads of questions coming, so enough from me. And Victoria Suarez, would you like to ask your question directly if you want to unmute yourself, if you can do that?
Sure. Thank you, Peter, for your time this evening. So I have a couple of questions. One of them is related it's more a general question, but how do you ensure that the public service, the public transport, which is an super important service for the city, stays relevant to the changing needs of citizens in the city itself? And I'm thinking particularly, a recent example is this new net zero strategy, which I feel affects a lot public transport and how we move in the city, and taking into account all the little pieces that the public transport entails, how do you make sure, what are the mechanisms in place to make sure that this service stays relevant? And let me ask you the second one, so I let you answer at your pace. But so the second one is about what you mentioned at the very beginning, that is that most people don't end up in the public transport or the transport sector because they're passionate about transport, but because of other things. So given that this is such an important service for the city, how do you keep people motivated to do a great job in this industry?
Okay, so I think the first thing is that actually you're right, that actually the thing has to evolve over time. And actually it's part of the challenge on the second question, which is that change in anything you do is, change is a constant feature, but actually a lot of what you do has to evolve over time. And it's the reason, frankly, why you want the mayor to be re-elected, and you want to know what's in their new manifestos. And there's another piece that I didn't talk about with Tony, which is that with a mayor who's already in office, you've got much more influence over their manifesto for re-election than you have for the first election. So I had no influence over what Boris set out in his manifesto. I was a bit of a victim for all the things that he'd picked up from people telling him what he should do. And it's a bit iterative, because you're right, the city is changing all the time. So one answer is that those bits of the transport service which are capable of changing, there is a mechanism for change. The bus service changes all the time. The routes that are running today are not the same routes as they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. With very few exceptions, there is one. Route 24 from Hampstead Heath to Pimlico has run between the same two places since 1911, but it's the only route in London that's done that, and everything else has changed because the demand on the system changes, and you have to have a mechanism for doing that. Then there's longer term change, which is either external change like the drive for air quality or the desire for new railways, which sometimes, Crossrail, which is almost finished, but not, sadly, not quite. Crossrail, depending on your historic viewpoint, was either first invented in 1890 or at least in 1944, and it'll be finished sometime in 2022. So that's taken an age, and that's why you need a transport strategy. And it's also why you need a decent planning department, and you need to keep yourself abreast of it. In fact, on the air quality stuff, because of the size of London, of Transport for London, and the size of the bus network, we drove the technological change which has resulted in battery buses. And we didn't do it entirely on our own, but our purchasing power ensured that that technology got manufactured far faster than it otherwise would have done. The other question is about motivation. And I think people don't generally join passionate for transport, but I think that they get the idea, most of them, that what they do is valuable. But you shouldn't be naive enough to believe that people don't need the money. And in fact, the industrial relations of transport systems in this country and probably elsewhere in the developed world, usually the trade unions are very highly developed, and they know that what they produce is very perishable. And they know that the threat of a dispute, unlike a manufacturing plant where you just don't make any cardboard boxes or cars for the day, if you don't produce any transport, it's quite hard for the city to function. So there's quite a dynamic about the power of organized labor and how much they're paid. And quite a few of them come to work for the money. So you don't pay them enough. There aren't enough of them. And that was at the root of many of the staff shortages for years and years and years on London's transport. But still, people are quite committed. And despite all of the militancy of the staff on the underground, actually, it's still the case that when the weather's bad, attendance goes up. People who might say to themselves, I might go on strike, think it's snowing this morning, people will need me to come to work, I better make an effort. It's completely extraordinary. And Boris once said to me, he said, we were in the middle of some underground dispute or other, and he said, forgive my language, he said, these bastards, why don't we fire them all? And I said to him, these are the same people who went into the tunnels on the 7th of July 2005 and rescued the dying and the injured. And he said, they can't be. And I said, yes, they are, but they're trade unionists as well. The fact that they're on strike and on strike for the wrong reason doesn't mean that they're not real human beings with views and opinions. And they're the same people who, given the weather that we've had in the last few days, actually will turn up for work, especially even when they don't feel like it, because it's a public service and they're needed. There, if you think there's a conundrum there, then there is. And it's part of the management job to keep people motivated in circumstances where they don't always feel it themselves.
Okay, right. And thanks very much for that excellent opening question, Victoria. And I'm going to move on to a related one, because you mentioned the bombings. Scott Russell, do you want to ask your question?
Yes, thank you. Very interesting conversation. And I just sent a note to Isabel Dedring telling her that her brilliance has been confirmed by a third party. So thank you for that.
So much for the chat amount.
Well, that's okay. That's okay. I don't mind.
I wanted to ask a bit more about TfL's response to July 7th, to the bombings, and what, from your perspective, contributed to the organization's performance and resilience in its immediate response, and were there factors that impeded your response that you had to overcome as a team to continue to perform during that period?
Because it's a great question, but for those who on the call who may not absolutely be on top of what happened, this was a major terrorism incident, but why don't you tell the story, Peter?
Sure. So the guts of it are that four suicide bombers turned up one sunny morning, and three of them let their bombs off on the tube and on the underground, and one of them let their bomb off on a bus. He was actually couldn't get into the tube because the tube was already disrupted through the activities of his three compatriots, and 50 odd people were killed, and a lot of people were injured, and it was a pretty gruesome day. So the truth is that these organizations are not run from the top down. If I as the transport commissioner and Andrew Haynes as my chief executive of Network Rail take a day off, it all still runs. And actually, the reason why it went okay on the 7th of July is that the people doing operational jobs know what their sphere of action is. So there was terrible damage to three trains and it was very hard. But actually, the emergency services are fantastic. And we had plans for what you do if you've got an event on the tube which is has death and serious injury, and sadly there was just more of it, and it consumed the entire services of the fire service and the ambulance providers and the police in central London. And as far as the bus service was concerned, actually the bus was the explosion in the bus happened just up the road from the LSE in Russell Square. And by the time that happened, the whole of central London was full of police vehicles and ambulances and fire service people. And it became evident that you couldn't run either much of a tube service or a bus service in central London. And operationally, I took no decisions at all. It was all done for me. They rang me up and they said, do you know what, Governor, we can't run the bus service in central London. There's so many roads closed and we're going to have to do what we do. And I just said, yeah, fine, thanks for telling me, because that's all you can do. Good funny story. We got to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. and they were still working on the tube, and there were still parts of central London closed. But actually, none of the bus service was running in central London, and it began to dawn on me that unless we did something, there were several million people in central London who wouldn't get home. So I said to Kylie, I said, I think I'll start the bus service at 3 o'clock. And I rang the most senior police officer I could get hold of, and I said, you don't think there are any more of these, do you? And he said, well, I don't know. And I said, well, I don't know either, but what I do know is there's 4 million people not going to get home unless we do something. So I started it. And I ran the control center, and I said, where you can, put the bus service back and take people home. And about half an hour after I'd done that, I got a phone call, and a voice said at the end of the phone, this is a message from the Home Secretary from COBRA, which is the government's emergency bunker. He said, you can start running the public transport services now. And I said, well, thanks very much, but I've already done that because I know what I'm doing. And I know that was Charles Clark. I never heard from him again, so I've got no idea whether they told him I'd already done it or not. But that's the only thing I did. And that wasn't a bad thing to do, because I'm not sure that anybody who worked for me would quite have thought that actually it was their job to start it again. And I thought, if I don't do something, and did I know that nothing else was going to happen? I didn't. But what I did know is you can't leave 4 million people in central London and not give them a way of getting home. And the tube clearly wasn't going to run that day. I think we stood up fairly well to that. And Tony will remember that for several years afterwards, there were endless commissions and inquiries and people writing learned papers about how you could have done it better and different. And I don't think we could have done it better or any differently. I think what we proved was that our operational organization was up to doing it, actually. And I'm pretty proud of that.
Yes, I mean, I think there were some revelations, I think mostly to do with the availability of emergency services, radios underground. That was the main thing that we all learned. But I think everything else was seen as, you know, in the great scheme of things, having worked as well as humanly could have done, I think, in fairness. And I also remember on that day that the Highways Authority, to their credit, came up with the simplest way of ensuring people didn't drive into central London, which was on the gantries approaching the city, simply said, drivers switch on radio, yep. Which is a very effective short way of not confusing people. Right, now, Ros Taylor, I think it's you. Do you want to ask this question, or do you want me to ask it?
I'm happy to ask it. Apologies, I won't show you the background because I'm just cooking my dinner. I'd be interested to know how you think the train operating companies are going to get people back on the network post-COVID, because after all, we've all been told not to travel. There will be a lot of hesitation about travel. And then there's the fact that people are remote working so much more and will want to carry on. What strategies do you think, from a public policy point of view, they will they want to deploy?
So I spend a lot of
people from all over the world in this call, Peter. So every transport utility in the world must be wondering about this.
Yeah, and they all are. We're all talking to each other about it. I mean, the first thing to say is that, so Jonathan Van Tam, who's become a TV hero as a result of his appearances on the number 10.
Deputy Chief Medical Officer in the UK for those from overseas.
Really nice bloke. And Andrew and I had a chat with him 3 weeks ago. He turns out to have a model railway in his back garden. So we instantly bonded. And we said to him, you know, what are we going to do about these messages saying don't use public transport, which don't really mean that. What they mean is stay at home because you don't want the virus. And he said, don't bother. He said, don't bother with any more scientific studies. Wait for vaccination to take effect for the over 50s. It will happen. And it is happening. To give him credit, it is happening now. And he said, by the summer, you'll be able to go back to something like normal, because there'll be sufficient both the immunity and vaccination in the community for that message to stop. So we've given up fretting and we're just waiting for that to happen. As to what will happen, well, it's really interesting, and that's why, in a sense, this lockdown this time has been more as revealing as last time. I mean, I don't know about any of you on the call. I cannot wait to get out from this. I'm fed up with sitting here shouting at the screen all day, and most other people are. And those people who predicted the demise of mass transit by everybody working at home, I think are wrong. And I think a lot of people, especially young people, I see people who are really harassed at home. So, you know, young parents living in a small flat with one or two children. How the bloody hell are you supposed to do any work? And the truth is that we're sociable people. Now, that doesn't mean we'll go back to 100% mass transit commuting. I don't think we will. I think that trend had already started, actually. And in fact, Friday on TfL and the railway already had much less volume and a few more people going back to the country for the weekend. And Monday had started to be like that. I think we've probably got a job not to persuade the whole world only to go into work on a Wednesday, because it will be a terrible thing for public transport economy to find the peak lasted for one day a week. So we'll have to do something probably with pricing and with public messaging about that. But I think most of it will come back simply because we want to be with people. You know, I can't bear this. I'd love to be with you all. And I even better, I'd like to go out with a drink with you afterwards and talk to you informally, and we can't do it like this. So, and of course, we may not ever get all the volume back. And if we don't, we'll have to make sure that we're not over providing infrastructure or rolling stock or staffing. But the other interesting thing, which has been in really, really interesting to me, if you cast your mind back to last summer, actually, when there was a bit of a relaxation, suddenly the trains to coastal resorts were absolutely crammed on summer Saturdays. We'd never seen anything like it. And I can see that we might well go back to a position, particularly because nobody's going to be able to go abroad on holiday for probably 3 or 4 years. We might yet wind up on the railway with our maximum loads being on summer weekends. And actually, that's only going back to the 50s and 60s. Yeah. The railway of my youth had more rolling stock. Some of it was only used for 6 weeks a year to take people on holiday. And we might be going to that. And if we do, we've got to change our habits and we've got to stop doing engineering work at weekends in the summer. And we'll have to transfer it maybe to doing, you know, Fridays and Mondays during the week when there are less people traveling. And actually, we'll just have to adapt. And the railway's pretty, you know, public transport's pretty good at adapting. And my job and Andrew's job and Andy Byford at TfL's job is to make sure that as we see this emerging, we're dexterous enough to cope with it.
I mean, I think one of the questions for me, and I'll move on to the next question, is how far governments, not only in the UK, are going to have to reverse the messaging. They've all been reversing a sort of lockdown, stay at home messaging. Governments are just as capable of reversing it out and saying, go to work to save the economy. Well, if it works one way, it could be made to work the other, in my personal view. But that's a policy question.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And the other thing that I think may be permanent is it's going to be a long time before people want to crowd onto the tube and commuter railways and actually have their nose stuck in somebody else's armpit after this COVID. That might take 3 or 4 years, actually, before people are willing to do that again. And that will probably compensate for the lack of volume that we get back. Because if we don't get 100%, there'll be a little bit more room and you'll be able to stand a little bit more comfortably and a little less near somebody else.
Well, I'm going to come on to a question about the high-speed 2 at the very end, but I'm not going to get there yet. So Pietro Guglielmi, who's going to make, based on an Italian question, railways in Italy, but for many of us spent part of our youths travelling Italy on Ferrovie dello Stato trains, and always interesting it was too. Anyway, Pietro, do you want to ask this question yourself?
Yes, thank you. So my questions are actually two. One on the local transport service, so the Milanese and Rome version of TfL, and on the National Railway Service. So okay, my questions are a bit long, but so the first one would be
as short as you can, but go for it. Go on.
Yeah. So the local transport services lose a lot of money every year, hundreds of millions of euros, because they have a lot of employees, more than necessary. So the basic question is, what is the feasible path for the transition from public firms that just provide jobs, you know, pork barrel policies, the transition to being modern local transport services that are not a burden to the general taxation, and whether there is any path alternative to privatization. And the second is related, but concerning, again, another example from Italy, the monopolist train service. So both the infrastructure and the train service are monopolist and owned by the Treasury. And so the question is, again, how can you do this transition? How can you counteract the specific, you know, the particular interest and allow for this transition for better service and lower costs for citizens? Thank you.
Well, they're
good questions. Go for
it. Yeah, they're brilliant questions. And actually, so one of the things I've done in my career is that I was the president of the UITP, which is the International Public Transport Organization, for 2 years. And I have a number of good friends around the world, all of whom wrestle with these problems just as I did. And in fact, the guy who used to run ATM in Milan, Bruno Rota, is a really good friend of mine. And he did a very good job in Milan. And then poor old Bruno went to Rome, and Rome was completely beyond him. Nobody has ever managed to run the public transport system in Rome because it's corrupt, apart from anything else, I think. But the questions are the same all over the world. And actually, I think if you look at TfL, there's quite an interesting answer. So when I got in charge of TfL, we had a completely publicly operated underground, but with privately provided infrastructure. We had a concessionaire on the Docklands Light Railway. The buses were provided by private companies under contract. We ran the taxis as a regulator's job, and they're all owned by largely by individuals. And it's a huge mixture of economic methods of provision. And I tried not to change any of it except where it didn't work, because my view, and it's still my view, is that you don't want to change any of that if it works. And it's more about good management than it is about anything else. And Bruno ran a really good service in Milan. He was a very talented manager, and he's not a transport person. He used to run Italian motorway service stations, but I got on with him like a house on fire, because he got what the service was trying to provide, and he ran a good service because he realized that's what you were supposed to do. And I'm not bothered, actually, about whether it's publicly or privately owned. I think I'm really very bothered about the competence and the quality of the management, and to some extent their incentivization. Now, you don't need to pay people as much as they might get otherwise in the private sector, because quite a lot of the best transport managers are just as committed to the job as many of the employees are. So you need to pay them enough to take the responsibility. And I'm not persuaded that necessarily private ownership is a good thing. But the other question, which is inherent in what you're saying, is that actually providing a good transport service in a city is not about loss and profit. It's about making the city work. And I could make money tomorrow out of running the London bus service. Many of you wouldn't get to work or college or the LSE in the rush hour, because I would ferociously price the peak in order to reduce capacity, in order to limit the number of vehicles I needed to provide, and I could run a bloody good service and make some money out of it. But I would do the economy of the city huge damage, because quite a lot of low paid people couldn't get to work. Now, the question is not whether or not you lose money or not. The question is, what's the point of doing it? And the point of the bus service in London is to take the last bus load of kids and shop workers to school and work in the morning peak, and to bring them home in the evening, because that's more important for the economy of the city than the economy of the public transport system. Now, since my time, Mike Brown had to live with less subsidy, and currently Andy Byford, who's now the transport commissioner, is trying to run TfL with government grants, because COVID's collapsed the income. But he got pretty close to running the thing with almost no subsidy. And that's a very brave and a very talented managerial thing to do. But depending on how the city's laid out, it's probably not the right thing to do, because if in the end you have to charge fares that stop poor people taking marginal jobs, you're not doing the city much good. And those are different issues from who owns it. And it's about management, and it's about motivation, and it's about whether you can recognise the purpose of doing it. And in fact, even though our train companies are privatised, the railway currently is consuming a huge amount of public money, but partially because the government thinks that it's worth continuing to run it. And I'm more agnostic about ownership than I am about getting the right management in, and about explaining to government why they should pay for whatever it is that they want.
I mean, Peter, I can tell the stories. I tell about Peter out of his hearing, but he and I had lunch a number of years ago. And at that time, another senior executive in charge of money at TfL at the time was much more interested in pricing. And Peter, of course, I think it's fair to say you'd see yourself as more of you've just described yourself as more of a public service person. And you said of the other person, I won't give the other person's name, but he'll know, said if X had his way, he'd auction the seats for the bus at the door of the bus. Yeah. And that to make the point, and it's an interesting public policy thought, knowing that if it was raining or you were late, you'd pay more. But if you were just, you got, you know, time, value of time was low, you wouldn't. So the difference between a fare regime, and there's a big debate in London about this all the time, how much you can abstract from different fare systems and regimes and tiering, and how much you're there to provide a service. Well, Peter's just elegantly explored that. Now, Venus, I just want you to say something that I think it's a nice remark, and it'd be nice if you said it. Go on.
Sure. I mean, I'm from New York City, and I apologize for my camera. I've been having internet issues with 24 inches of snow and trees coming down, but talking about a different type of infrastructure. But Andy Byford was a really great addition to our public transportation system here. And unfortunately, because of politics with the mayor and the governor, that sort of blew that opportunity of any reform or changes, any permanent changes that he could have made. But the ones that he did make, I thought were pretty fantastic, but we blew it.
Yeah.
Do you want to go on a little, either of you, have a little discussion about it? Because I think it's so interesting that Andy Byford, who had been at Transport for London, or London Transport, then went to Australia, I think, then to New York. Ended up in the middle of a political tangle in New York City State, and then immediately came to London when the pandemic happened and found himself in the middle of another set to between different levels of government. Is that fair to you? Is that how both of you see it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you should get Andy on here, and he would be, if he's honest, he would be very good to talk to. But I think New York did blow it. He's a very talented guy, but the problem with the MTA in New York has always been that it reports to the state governor, not to the mayor. So the mayor carries.
It depends on what day you see and who wants to get money and who wants to give money, because I think that's always been the case, regardless of who's been in those two seats. I think when it's the whatever governor is there wants to have control when making appointments, et cetera. But when it's time to cough up money in the state budget, well, that's New York City's problem.
Sure. And I think it's a governance mistake, actually, because, you know, up until the pandemic, one of the good things in London is that the mayor was wholly responsible. And if you've been following the fact that the mayor and the government don't get on, they're playing politics over funding TfL, which is an essential service for London. And I think it's a great shame. And that's probably a sort of mild rerun of what's gone on in New York. Now, the great thing is Andy's already done that once, so he's got some form on understanding how you might behave in those circumstances. And I think he's played a pretty good hand of cards, actually. And I know what he's doing, because I do it myself, which is that he's saying, well, you are all politicians and you can argue about this. All I need is sufficient money to run this system properly, and I'm determined to make the case to do it to all of you. So I'm neither against all of you, neither am I in favour of you. What I need is enough money to run the system properly. But I think there's a wider point, which is that if you're in charge of transportation in a world city, you're bound to have to deal with this politics. The people I worked for in London Transport 40 years ago couldn't bear the thought of dealing with grubby politicians. And a lot of people who I still rub up against in the railway and in public transport generally say, oh my God, you've got to deal with those politicians. Well, you have, because they've got all the money and they also get elected. So there's no point in thinking somehow that you can be rid of them. What you've got to do is to advocate the cause that you need to do for the service you're providing for the city and make it possible for them to help you. And Andy here is playing, I mean, he played a good game in New York, but in the end, he resigned because the state governor was determined to undermine him. And I think actually that's one of the reasons he got the job in London. And he's got really powerful position now because people, if you look at Andy, you can say, well, he won't put up with it. If the politicians screw him about, he'll go.
I think it's really, just to interrupt, I think it's really interesting point, Peter. I'm sorry to end your, because he's arrived at a point when, you know, there's a mayoral election due this year, the Labour mayor way ahead in the polls, Conservative government actually doing quite well in the polls, and they're rubbing up against each other. And Andy Byford, I think, has begun to act as a kind of arbiter between...
Yes, he has. Yes,
absolutely. Very interesting piece of micropolitics for an official... But and you do this as well, Peter. So you know it's a really intriguing, the idea that officials can arbitrate between different levels of government. Fascinating. I'd add one other thing because it's just come up. Peter's, you made the point, having a transport authority for a city to the same boundaries probably is a good thing. There was a World Bank people here a few years ago, and they made this point that if you have jurisdictions where the transport in a city effectively is run as in New York by a state, where upstate you've got lots of people living in rural areas who are not that worried about, you know, the quality of the service on the L train. You can see how that makes for bad politics, or at least in London, everybody knows it's Sadiq Khan or nobody, and the commissioner, if things don't work. And the elections are on that basis and the money's on that basis. Anyway, thanks for that, Venus. That's very helpful. Now, I'm going to take Carolina and then Adnan. So, Carolina, do you want to ask your question?
Yes, thank you. So, many thanks, Peter, for sharing your experience. It's really interesting to get the vision and how things work in practice. So my question is kind of related with that. It's based on the experience we've had in Chile, where policies and reforms for the public transport system have been like highly dependent on political priorities of incumbent governments. And like, even though all of them agree on the need for change, politics have provoked constant failures, like in all the reforms they've tried to make. So in that sense, you mentioned strategic plans for the public transport system and its development. And I was wondering how well that long-term vision is carried out in practice and like thinking on changes in priorities because of shorter political cycles in government. Like, what do you think is the key to achieve that long-term vision for the system, accounting for those changes in political priorities?
It's a really good point. And one of the first things you realise, certainly with railways, because railway infrastructure costs the earth and takes a long time to deliver, is that politicians always wind up opening their predecessors' pet projects. And so... You know, that what you persuade a politician to support in their term of office is virtually never delivered in the same term of office. So I think what you've got to do, that's why the London system of the mayor owning the long-term spatial and economic development strategy and then having to own the transport strategy is really good, because what you need to do as the transport authority is to sell the incoming mayor the long-term policies that will drive the success of the city. And if the incoming, providing you've got a plan, so if the incoming mayor doesn't know what they are, you've got to tell them. And I can remember one evening, Boris Johnson rang me up as he was cycling home on his bike after probably quite a good dinner. And he said to me, why don't we build another cable car? If you don't know what the cable car is, go away and research it. But he made us build a cable car, which is probably not a very good use of public money, but he did want it done, so we did it. And I said to him, let's not do that, Boris. Why don't we do the next thing in the transport strategy? Oh, he said, what's that? I said, well, it's Crossrail 2. Oh, yeah, we'll do that then. And actually, I mean, that's an extreme example, but I sold him the right thing for him to advocate next. And to be fair to the guy, he advocated it consistently. The fact that the government's now put it on hold is the same man in different places, different thing. But actually, you need a long-term plan to do that. And if I compare that with my current position with the British railway system, one of our weaknesses is we don't have a long-term strategy. So every new Secretary of State comes into office and he says, why don't we reopen the line to Portishead, which is near Bristol? And you think, was that on our scheme? No, it wasn't. Are we going to have to deal with it? Well, we probably are, because we don't have anything to say, no, let's not do that. Let's do something else. And that's why you need a long-term plan. But there is a great mismatch. And actually, one of the jobs you have to do with this system, which needs long-term investment, is to sell your plan to an incoming politician. And if they can't bear it, you'll have to alter the plan or get out, because actually they need some things that they've got to champion. And to be fair to both of the mayors, we had some good discussions with them over why you should do some things and why you shouldn't do others and what the effect of doing them would be. And generally, Crossrail has been supported by all the mayors, and it is the right thing to do. And actually, the development, which has been of both jobs and housing, which are a consequence of better transport, have in fact arrived before the line is open. So that, you know, we've proved that result is a good thing. But it's tough, because the short political cycles, you know, one of the first things that Boris did in railway terms was to open an extension of the overground. There was outrage, because actually it was Ken's idea and Ken had instigated it, but Boris opened it. But that's how it works, you know.
Okay, thanks for that, Peter. Now we've got about 9 minutes to go. I'd like to get Adnan, my colleague Adnan, another associate dean. Adnan, go for it.
Thanks, Tony. Many thanks, Peter. Fascinating session, great insights. I'm particularly interested in hearing more from you on engaging with politics. So we are a public policy school preparing a policy professional and a policy analyst. And while we deal with the technical skills, all of us have to deal with politics. And the typical responses are, politics is too messy, let's not get involved, let's stay out of it. Or on the other hand, the other extreme is some people get too close to or become too politicized with a particular regime or with a particular politician. You have a great experience of delivering under different regimes, different politicians, surviving political change. But also the art of delivering to politicians or developing plans for politicians to deliver what they promised without necessarily committing to the means or the instruments for achieving that or their previous announcements. So I'm wondering if you could share your insights on how to deal with this tension.
Well, one of them is that you want to keep, I think most days I still want to keep in the job. But as Tony mentioned right at the start, I did make enough money once that I don't have to if I don't want to, and I'm 67. So I kept my bus driving license for a long time in the belief that I might need it one day if I got fired, but I probably don't need it anymore. But you need a certain amount of compulsion to do it, but you also need to feel that actually I wouldn't do something that I really didn't believe in. And on a bad day with Boris, I used to, and with Ken actually once or twice, I used to go home and think, you know, shit, what, is this really worth it? I don't have to do this if I don't want to. And that's a nice feeling, even though you don't, but you also have to be driven by the loyalty of the people who work for you, because you know, there are many, many people in these organizations who are passionately committed to doing what they're doing, and they deserve both support and defense. And, you know, I'm supposed to be fairly feisty, but I'm not sure I am, but I'll bloody well argue if I think somebody is wrong about their view of the organization. And I will argue with them. And I used to argue with the media, and I used to argue particularly with bad media, because I think the organization needs to be defended. But equally, I mean, you know, when they're elected, you know, the mayor of London's got a mandate, got the largest political mandate in Britain. They got elected. Whether you care about whether what they really think or how they got elected, it doesn't matter. They got the position. And actually, you know, they're elected and you're appointed and they appoint you. So you better remember that they can fire you, which works both ways, because if you don't want to work for them, you don't have to. But also they're people. And actually, I got on with Ken. I still do. I get on with Boris. Actually, he's a very funny bloke. He's a mean sod. You take him out for dinner and he always makes you pay. But hey, you know, and actually, why wouldn't you try and get on with them? Because, you know, except for one particular Secretary of State who's not there anymore, I've got on with all the Secretaries of State, more or less. And you're trying to get them, you know, what I want them to do is to share what they think they're trying to do with you, rather than with what you're responsible for, rather than just giving you instructions. You know, that's why that thing about the Blackwall Tunnel is instructive. What I wanted Boris to understand was that if I could explain to him what he really thought he wanted to do, I might be able to do it. And you want a personal relationship to do that. And even if you don't like them much, the personal relationship, if they'll explain to you what they want, we'll try and do it, unless it's either illegal or immoral or it's really repugnant, in which place you better go and they better hire somebody else. But actually, they're I mean, you know, I don't want to be a politician. I think you have to be, frankly, you've got to have a flaw in your personality to subject your career to periodic re-election. I think it's a pretty poor way of getting a career. But also, I hope that I've shown you all that I do care about what I do. You know, running a good transport system isn't optional. It's actually what you're paid for, and I care about that quite a lot. And if you know, I don't do it now because I've got a chief executive and he knows what he's up to and he's very good. But in TfL days, if I saw that the service was bad first thing in the morning, I would ring people up and shout at them, because the public deserves better, and you should care about that, and you should care about it enough to go and defend it when it needs defending, but also say we got it wrong and I'm sorry, and I've done that and I still do it, actually, because people care about the service you're given. And all of that is, it's not different from politics. I think it's what you take as the corporate and professional responsibility of what you're doing, and then they control the money, and you better argue with them about how they spend the money and where they spend it and how much you need. And you won't always win, and you've got to be loyal to them, you know. And frankly, sometimes I'll defend them, even if I'm not sure privately that it's worth defending. But I'll defend the government at the moment. We have spent, I think we've had £9 billion worth of support for the Great British Railway System since it was shut down in March. And we're still running trains, and the thing is empty, and we haven't had a station shut. It's bloody remarkable. I'll defend that, because I'm very proud of the fact that they've done it for us. And even Andy will defend them. He's had quite a lot of difficulty getting enough money for TfL, but he's got it and he's still running a service. And that's pretty damn good, because if we were in the airline industry or the coach industry, we'd have gone bust. But it's also a reflection on how important it is what you do. And I think that's what drives me. I do it for almost anybody except a crook or somebody who's immoral, and I would take it on myself to argue with them, at least as long as they tolerate the argument, to get the right outcomes. And I think you should, and okay, I think that's a responsibility.
Now we've got 2 minutes to go. I've got one very short question from Pietro, and then I'm going to do the high speed two question for Elliot, and then we'll have to stop. Pietro, so do it short and sharp, and if you can answer short and sharp as well, Peter, that'd be good.
Okay.
Pietro, go for it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Tony. So just as a follow-up on your previous reply, my question on subsidies on local transport systems, don't you think it's a bit unfair to have the general taxation to subsidize the local transport system? So for a citizen of Birmingham or Manchester to pay for my bus ride, so shouldn't I pay the ticket a bit more? Or alternatively, if we want progressive local taxes to pay for them, to allow for, you know, a progressive way of charging citizens, shouldn't local taxes subsidize local transport system? Thank you.
Quick answer. Britain, my predecessor, Kylie, who's dead now, sadly, he said once that he thought Britain had the most centralized government of any country in the world, apart from North Korea. So the government collects tax or compared with any other first, second or third world city, the government's proportion of taxation compared with local taxation is far greater. And I think in those circumstances, I think it's pretty reasonable for the government to shell out for transportation in the capital city, and in particular when it exports so much tax to the rest of Britain. I think, Tony, you'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, I chaired the London Finance Commission, both for Boris Johnson and again for Sadiq Khan. And we did argue for more local resource raising. And in fairness to the proposals that Transport for London has put forward to the government for the long-term funding of the gap between what's likely to be the fare revenue for the next few years and the needs to run the operating costs of the services, they are proposing the possibility of more locally raised tax.
Yes.
So actually, it could help with devolution of tax raising powers, rather oddly. However, let's move on to Elliot's. We're just going to run over for 2 minutes. This is a humdinger to end with. Elliot Sharp's question. You want to ask them, Elliot? Go on.
Oh, okay. So, thank you again, Peter, for this really insightful discussion. So at the beginning of this conversation, you discussed both your shared experiences with HS2, and you emphasized the importance of strategic planning. So I was wondering, what was your perspective on the current failures of HS2 delivery, and what did you consider the remaining challenges of delivering HS2 after the PAC reviews and the subsequent government consultations?
Again, well, for the overseas, those of you not followed it from overseas, High Speed 2 is, as I said earlier, you say it, Peter, but it's a very expensive, short piece of high-speed railway, Peter.
It is, from between London and Birmingham and then to Manchester and Liverpool. Well, I'm not sure there are failures. I think if you look at the global history and the long-term history of large-scale infrastructure projects, there are almost none of them which have ever been done in the time their promoters said and at the cost they alleged was the cost. And if you look back at the glorious history of building railways in Britain in the Victorian era, one of the first speeches I made at Network Rail, I said Brunel's Great Western Railway cost 3 times what he predicted. And I got the following day a letter in green ink from some old railway engineer. He said, "You're entirely wrong. You've got no idea what you're talking about. It cost 4 times what Brunel said it would." And the truth of it is that the cost estimates for HS2 were baked in before anybody had the faintest idea about how to do that project. And indeed, I wouldn't dare to remind him, but Boris himself, as a constituency MP, was partially responsible for putting the line in tunnel virtually the whole way from Euston to 2/3 of the way to Birmingham, in order to save disturbance in suburban and rural constituencies, which has of course multiplied the price and the timescale enormously. But actually, and Tony can tell you this afterwards and better than I can probably, the business case doesn't look very good over 20 years. But then the business case for the Great Western Railway nearly bankrupted the shareholders in 1835. We're still using the infrastructure. It's pretty well built, actually, though some of the Victorian stuff isn't. So the business case of the original British Railways over the period of time they've existed has been absolutely brilliant. So it's a short-term perspective, and it's hell to manage, and I don't want to be in charge of HS2. It's bad enough chairing the thing about Euston Station, never mind the rest of it, because there's a whole pile of people saying, well, you said it would cost this and it's going to cost that. In the end, I'm afraid it will cost what it costs. And it, has it got a business case? Well, in the end, of course, you go back to the previous question. It's a political decision. If the politicians have decided that they want Britain's capital city connected with its three other commercial hubs in England by a faster train service, they're absolutely entitled to decide it. It will take far longer than any of their terms of office to build. And the result will be a permanent change in the way the British economy works. And in the end, that's a political, economic and social decision, not a transport decision. And it's right that it should be like that. I don't want to be in charge of it. And I think anybody, you know, even the people in charge of it now won't see the other end of the scheme because it won't be finished in 2030. But are politicians entitled to take big decisions that change the course of life in our country? Well, I think they are. And it's just foolish to believe that you know that absolutely the cost of it at the time that you take the decision. And now we're in the middle of a pandemic and borrowing is worse now than it's been for decades. But should we carry on with it? Well, if we don't, we'll have lost a lot of, we'll have wasted a lot of money and we won't have anything to show for it.
I mean, I just had one in a sort of public policy sense. I think one of the problems High Speed 2 has had, and I'm, you know, agnostic to, about High Speed 2. I think one of the problems it has, and often projects have, and not only in the UK, is the stop-go nature of the way the industry is expected to deliver these projects. And so, whilst in fairness to successive governments in the UK, there's been a reasonable pipeline of railway projects and rebuilding of railways in the last 20 years, it certainly isn't like that over the last 60 years. And, you know, it's,
frankly,
the right way to do things.
It's generated a lot of cost, but actually it's not a very good way of doing things. But I mean, the other thing is that the name is a misnomer, as Tony and I well know. It is a high-speed railway, but its purpose is more railway capacity. And it's a shame it's not advocated like that, because it would be much more understandable for many people if it were. Anyway, that's
we must finish. We've slightly overrun, and it was worth it, I think. First, read the last comments yourself down there in the chat, Peter. Thank you very, very much indeed, not only for coming along and taking part in this, you know, less desirable than if we were in the same room, but nevertheless great fun event, but also for your disarming openness and honesty and straightforwardness. It is a Chatham House rule event in answering the questions and actually, you know, talking from deep experience on the challenge of running a major, complex, highly visible, consumer-driven public service. And that is itself a complicated idea, a consumer-driven public service. Yet dealing with politicians. So thank you ever so much for doing that. We hope we can come and see you perhaps on another occasion when we can meet in the same room or vice versa. So it just leaves me to say that thank you. We can give you a sort of round of applause.
Virtual.
Okay, virtual. So you can see it all there. So thanks, Peter. And I'm afraid in the best traditions of things, everything will suddenly go dead as if we haven't paid the electricity bill when the Zoom meeting ends. But thanks ever so much.
No, thank you. I've enjoyed it too. So good luck to you all. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you.